Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the Supreme Court's rejection of New York Times reporter James Risen's claim of First Amendment protection of a source, which means the government can now compel the reporter to reveal his source or face jail time. Lisa Graves, the president of Progressive Inc., and a former Deputy Attorney General in the Justice Department, joins us to discuss the upholding of the U.S. Court of Appeals in Virginia's decision denying the existence of any reporter's privilege in the First Amendment or common law, and the Attorney General's recent remark that under his watch, no reporter doing his job is going to jail. Then we'll look into the Obama administration's plan to address climate change, with the EPA's new rules unveiled Monday to reduce CO2 emissions from coal-fired electrical plants by 30% from 2005 levels over the next 15 years. David Freeman, the former head of the Tennessee Valley Authority, New York Power, and the Los Angeles Department of Water and Power, joins us to discuss the political cost to Democrats in the coal states and whether eliminating coal plants and replacing them with natural gas-fired plants will reduce the current 40% of emissions from power plants that cause climate change, given the doubts about how much seepage of methane from the natural gas grid offsets the advantage of the smaller carbon footprint from burning natural gas. Then finally, we will talk with Jeremy Rifkin, the author of The Zero Marginal Cost Society, The Internet of Things, The Collaborative Commons, and The Eclipse of Capitalism. He joins us to discuss the third industrial revolution underway, where Germany is already generating 27% of its electricity from renewable energy, and China is investing an initial $82 billion in an alternative energy internet in which prosumers can make and share their own green energy. We'll also discuss his latest article at the Huffington Post, Beyond Obama's Plan, the New Economic Vision for Addressing Climate Change. And joining us now is Lisa Graves, who is the president of Progressive, Inc. And the publisher of alecexposed.org. She has served as a senior advisor in all three branches of the federal government, as a deputy assistant attorney general in the Justice Department, as chief counsel for nominations on the Senate Judiciary Committee, and as a deputy chief for the U.S. courts. She is also a professor of law at George Washington University. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lisa Graves.
Oh, Ian, thank you so much for having me on. And I previously worked with George Washington University, but now that I'm in Wisconsin, I've got my hands full with Progressive Magazine and Center for Media Democracy.
Well, we will update your bio accordingly. you're just hard to keep up with, Lisa.
I appreciate it.
So, what's your reaction then to this kind of disconnect, where Attorney General Holder recently said that no reporter under his watch is going to jail for doing his job? At the same time, the Obama administration joined in pressuring the Supreme Court to uphold the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fourth District of Virginia's decision denying the existence of any reporter's privilege in the First Amendment or common law. So what's going on here?
Well, I hope that Eric Holder keeps his word and does not prosecute this New York Times reporter for reporting about some matters after they occurred based on his investigative work regarding the activities of the CIA. And I think that the statement that James Risen won't go to jail, or any reporter doing his job won't go to jail, I hope there isn't a lot of wiggle room in there, because I think it would be a travesty for this Justice Department, for the Obama administration, to pursue this case in a way that puts a reporter in jail or subjects a reporter to thousands of dollars in fines for not disclosing a source. I wouldn't say that I'm optimistic, but I certainly hope that the Attorney General Eric Holder keeps his word.
So, in terms of the ruling, though, that from the Court of Appeals of the Fourth District in Virginia, it was a 2-1 ruling, and it does seem fairly. One of the judges, I think the dissenting judge, said, yes, it's as clear as mud. I mean, why support that ruling? I mean, I guess without a shield law, there is an ambiguity in the law. And I take it goes back to, 1972, a case? I'm trying to...
Yep.
1972, Brandenburg versus Hayes. So tell us about that case and why it ruling of this court cited that case.
Well, in this in the case at hand here with Mr. Risen, you have a Fourth Circuit, which is an extremely conservative circuit, and you have two judges who were on that three-judge panel that ruled against the reporter. Both of those judges had previously served in the military. And you have a situation in which one of the most conservative courts in the country is basically reinforcing the idea that this reporter has to testify and that there's no shield. That decision in some ways goes back to that earlier Supreme Court decision that you mentioned, the Brandenburg case from the early 1970s. That was a very narrowly decided case. It was a 5-4 ruling. There were a number of new Nixon judges on that court. Ultimately, the court ruled that there wasn't a constitutional privilege for reporters, but the conclusion from many who observed that case at the time so long ago was that there was a recognition that there was a common law privilege for reporters. I disagree with that case. I think that our First Amendment ought to protect and ought to be construed to protect the rights of reporters if it construes the right to have freedom of the press, which is expressly protected in that amendment. I think it's perhaps ironic or pathetic that this Supreme Court, which has gone out of its way to provide protections to corporations, to expand the rights of the richest few, to spend unlimited money to influence elections, to engraft that onto our First Amendment, can't see fit to actually protect rights that are actually in our First Amendment, including the freedom of the press.
So what is then, we don't know what the fate of James Risen is, and my understanding is he's prepared to go to jail. Even if Eric Holder has made this somewhat ambiguous offer, that's the disconnect. The law is proceeding now that the Supreme Court has thrown this back at Risen and exposing him to jail. Who's going to step in first? Is this court going to then go ahead to haul him in and I guess make him testify, which we know in advance he's not going to do, and then he's off to jail. Is that the next step here?
Well, it will be interesting, and I hope it won't be too awful to behold. This is a case in which the Justice Department, the Obama administration, has in fact supported, in some respects, the notion of a privilege, or at least a common law privilege for reporters. It has issued guidelines that purportedly provide greater protections for reporters than previously. At the same time, this administration has pursued aggressively leaks investigations more aggressively than I think all of the previous administrations combined, at least in court, perhaps not as aggressively as Nixon himself. But you have a situation in which you have a very aggressive Justice Department pursuing these leaks cases. And on the other hand, you have new rules that are supposed to provide greater protections for reporters. In the case of Brandenburg, where that reporter back in the 1970s who was doing reporting on on the drug trade in a particular state in Louisville, he was describing, what was happening with the war on drugs that Nixon was pursuing. In that case, after the Supreme Court ruled against that reporter, he left the state. He left Kentucky. He went to Michigan. In that case, the court held him in contempt and ordered him to be sentenced to 6 months in prison, according to one of the great books on constitutional law. And the only thing that protected Mr. Brandenburg in that case was that the governor of Michigan refused to extradite him to Kentucky. Now, in this case where you've got a federal court there in Virginia and you have a New York Times reporter, it's unclear that he could evade the long arm of the law if the court ordered him to be held in contempt or ordered him to be jailed or fined. So I think the risk is great. I think this is a dark day for our Constitution, one of many dark days that is the result of either the action or inaction of this United States Supreme Court and the judges that appear to be far too beholden to executive power.
Well, of course, the irony here is that the same Attorney General is offering this sort of somewhat ambiguous fig leaf, saying that no reporter on his watch is going to go to jail for doing his job, is the same Attorney General, Eric Holder, who in 2011 authorized the issuing of a subpoena compelling James Risen to testify in this trial of the CIA officer Sterling for a chapter in Risen's 2006 book, State of War, about a botched CIA attempt to derail Iran's nuclear program. So that's the part of it that I find extraordinary. And my understanding about this court in Virginia, in Northern Virginia, is that the CIA loves this court because it is so conservative, and they don't want to try them across the river. They always throw the book at them in Virginia.
Well, that's right. The Virginia courts, the federal courts in Virginia, have a reputation for being extremely conservative, being very favorable to the government. You know, I think that in this case, it is, you know, very worrisome that the administration has taken these steps. I actually think, you know, my view of the First Amendment is much closer to Justice William Douglas's view of the First Amendment. I think it's sort of really outrageous that there are rulings that would require citizens to testify before the grand jury against their will. I think that whether you're a reporter who observes something in the course of your investigation or whether you're a citizen who observes something, I don't think the state should compel you to testify against your will, even if you're not incriminating yourself. I think that that's really autocratic. I think it's inconsistent with our core values. But unfortunately, that decision, Brandsburg, in the Brandsburg case, is the law of the land based on that Nixon Supreme Court ruling many decades ago.
And Lisa Graves, again, the president of Progressive, Inc., she has served as a senior advisor in all three branches of the federal government, as deputy assistant attorney general in the Justice Department, as chief counsel for nominations on the Senate Judiciary Committee, and as deputy chief for the U.S. courts. You pointed out the irony of how much the Supreme Court that just tossed this ruling back to the Virginia Court of Appeals, have gone out of their way to empower the plutocrats in this country, like the Koch brothers and others, giving them unlimited political influence via the enormous financial resources that they have, and equating the right to donate unlimited amounts of money as a First Amendment issue. What's your sense then of where the press is the press standing up to this? I mean, I know perhaps the New York Times is, and I think the Associated Press have joined in the defense of Risen, but I don't see a great tidal wave of outrage.
Well, I think a couple things. One is that there are a number of reporters and reporting groups, as well as networks and others, that have submitted what are called amicus briefs or friend of the court briefs, calling on the court to protect the rights of reporters, to protect the freedom of the press. It just hasn't received much press, perhaps ironically, the press's defense of a reporter. There also has been a tremendous amount of grassroots activity. We know that Roots Action, David Swanson's efforts, along with Norman Solomon's efforts, which my organization, the Center for Media Democracy and Progressive Health, have joined in with, have sought to petition, use petitions to try to defend the freedom of the press, as well as using our own reporting and voices to cover these issues. And so, you know, there are a number of people who are very concerned about these judicial rulings and the actions of the administration. I can tell you from when I was over at the U.S. courts and the deputy chief of the Article III Judges Division over there that, you know, the courts are pretty remote in some respects. They're just, they really don't hear. They're not vehicles for democracy. And so in some ways, the only real vehicles when you're faced with this sort of legal precedent and this sort of push in the courts is to really take your case to the public and to the administration. And so I hope the administration hears from media groups and hears from citizens that they want the freedom of the press protected. They don't want reporters to be hauled into court and threatened with jail or fines and forced to reveal their sources.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Lisa Graves.
Thank you so much, Ian. Thanks for having me on.
Again, I've been speaking with Lisa Graves, who's the president of Progressive Inc. and the publisher of alecexposed.org. She has served as a senior advisor in all three branches of the federal government, as deputy assistant attorney general in the Justice Department, as chief counsel for nominations on the Senate Judiciary Committee, and as deputy chief for the U.S. courts. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about the Obama administration's new rules that the EPA is setting to reduce CO2 emissions from coal-fired plants by 30%. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is David Freeman, who is a leading authority on the production, management, and delivery of energy to large populations. He has had the ear of federal officials since the days of JFK and helped bring about the Environmental Protection Agency under President Nixon. He headed the Tennessee Valley Authority under President Carter, and he also headed New York Power and the Los Angeles Department of Water and Power, and was the state energy czar responsible for rescuing California from the predations of Enron and company. David Freeman is the author of Winning Our Energy Independence, and Energy Insider Shows How. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Freeman.
Oh, thank you for having me.
And what's your sense then of this announcement from the White House that the EPA's new rules were unveiled to reduce CO2 emissions from coal-fired electric generating plants by 30% from 2005 levels over the next 15 years? What kind of should we be celebrating that the White House is going green?
Well, there's two points of view. If you take the world's most awesome problem, which threatens to change life as we know it for almost everyone on Earth, and settle for a tiny move in the right direction, then you would applaud this. But if you are a citizen that's concerned about your kids and grandkids and expects leadership, you know, Franklin Roosevelt-type leadership from your president, this is a political document. Here's the situation. If you have three fires, the power plants are one fire, all the gas and oil that heats our buildings and homes is another fire, and the transportation sector is a third fire. So he's dealing with only one of three fires. And then then it's an inconvenient truth that methane is emitted to the air when you use natural gas. And that just destroys his all-of-the-above approach if he counts it. So he's not counting methane. He has a carbon attack on just the power sector, one fire. So there are two fires that will continue to burn unabated. And on this particular fire, we're going to substitute Marlboros for Camels, in a sense, natural gas for coal. Now, there will be some incremental improvements as a result of this, but they'll be tiny compared to the goal that he himself has set forth when he first became president, which is by 2050, we have to reduce emissions by 83%. In other words, we've got to get down to where emissions are only 13% of what they are today in all three fires. And, you know, the politically difficult ones are the ones that he's not touching at all, and the fire that is at least attackable through the EPA and the Clean Air Act This is an approach that lacks any bite, because he's ignoring the fact that methane is, in the first 20 years, is 80 times as bad as carbon. And we add the numbers together, almost all the experts now agree that natural gas is as bad as coal, yet he is not counting the methane. So it's a little sad that, unfortunately, politics is influencing the situation, as it always does. I can't condemn a president for being political, but I have to tell it like I see it.
Well, but most of the political commentators are saying, David Freeman, that the president's paying a political price, that Mitch McConnell may well be rescued by this ruling, that the coal states are all up in arms, and now this whole canard that Obama has a war on coal has traction with Republicans.
This may be the worst of all worlds. This may be a situation where a president who feels that he's trying to at least raise the issue and begin to move it in a right direction is doing something that's so politically unpopular that it actually hurts his party. It isn't going to hurt President Obama. He isn't up for re-election. It will hurt a few people, but frankly, I can't criticize him for that. Those Democrats have kids and grandkids, and the people in those states need to be educated. So I must say that it's hard for this liberal Democrat to shed any tears over Democrats that are behaving like Republicans, if I can be that partisan about it.
Well, David Freeman, it seems to me the problem here is that as it stands now, 40% of emissions from power plants they contribute 40% of the climate change gases at the moment.
Yeah, 38, and there's 62% that goes untouched. I mean, this prominent economist, Ted Northhouse, says it just like I do. No politician leader in the world has a serious agenda to combat climate change. I mean, this is not a serious agenda to get us to the goal the president himself laid out, which is virtually eliminating the greenhouse gases by 2050. We have to start. Let me tell you my major problem. Because I was in the utility business, and I know these power plants. When you build a new power plant in 2015, it is going to be running in 2050. And we can't afford to be running it. So we're building power plants that, in order to survive, we're going to either have to shut down, or we'll just go with the lemmings and it'll be all over. I mean, but we should have enough sense to realize that every new power plant ought to be solar, wind, with storage. We have those technologies. It is maddening that the technologies have advanced far faster than any political agenda, and we ought to be having all new power plants made of solar and wind if there was no climate problem, because they are fuel-free. The sun and the wind is free, and once you they last as long as the other plants, and once you've paid them off, it's free electricity. Look at the dams that we built in the 30s and 40s. I ran the New York Power Authority, and the power from Niagara and from St. Lawrence, we sold it for 1 cent a kilowatt hour to bring the aluminum industry to upstate New York, and we made 9 mills on it. It's virtually free. And the same will be true of the solar plants. The solar panels don't wear out. The windmills wear out occasionally, but they're replenished, and these plants go on. The average coal-fired power plant in America is almost 50 years old. So it's madness to be permitting anything that pollutes in the future, if we're really serious. And that means it would be a huge political fight, but it would be a fight worth fighting for. This is pablum.
Again, I'm speaking with David Freeman, who's a leading authority on the production, management and delivery of energy to large populations. He has had the ear of federal officials since the days of JFK and helped bring about the Environmental Protection Agency under President Nixon. He headed the Tennessee Valley Authority under President Carter. He also headed the New York Power and the Los Angeles Department of Water and Power, and was a state energy czar responsible for rescuing California from the predations of Enron and Company. And David Freeman is the author of Winning Our Energy Independence, and Energy Insider Shows How. So it seems to me that, you know, the coal plants, of course, coal is dying a natural death any rate, because of the introduction of natural gas plants that are replacing them. But the real problem here is, as you point out, that we don't know how much seepage of methane comes from the natural gas grid. I've done interviews with people, by the way, up in Stanford, who have done studies about how much seepage is coming from fracking and from the wellheads. And from the grids, but nobody's combined that with the grids that go into your home across the United States. So,
well, it's just not a secret that these gas pipelines underneath the city streets leak like crazy, 5% and 10%. We just got through blowing up a big part of New York City with a gas leak, and the Obama administration's methane task force is not even studying that part of it because they know they can't do much about it. I mean, if the leakage of methane is only 1.2%, then the numbers say that natural gas is as bad a greenhouse gas as coal. And I don't think there's anybody that knows anything about it that would try to claim that the leakage rate is as low as 1.2% overall, if you include the pipelines part of it. And so it's an inconvenient truth. He has an all-of-the-above policy, which he borrowed from BP, by the way. I mean, that was their policy, 57 in 07. But he's stuck. He's bragging about fracking and about how we're doing more oil and gas. And the climatologists are telling us if we burn only 20% of the petroleum reserves we've already discovered, that we've used up all the space there is in terms of surviving. The family doctor is screaming stop, and we're ignoring two-thirds of the fire and playing around with one-third, and accounting a shift from one poison to the other is progress. And still catching hell about it from the know nothing, do nothing crowd. It's just for someone that knows something about it, it's heartbreaking.
So, and the do nothing crowd is the ultimate irony that Mitch McConnell may get reelected for the worst possible reason.
But here they've gone in 30 seconds from saying it doesn't exist to saying it's too late to do anything about it.
You're right.
You know, if you think that we're that much smarter than the elephants and the other animals, ask again. And we may end up being this century's version of the dinosaurs.
So what then is, if there was a definitive study on the seepage of methane from across the entire grid, from extraction, production, shipping, and into the house, the pipeline that goes into your house when every house one time or other has smelt gas in the house, so it's ubiquitous. So would that help to get a real figure on this so that we can stop kidding ourselves?
I don't think that anybody that knows anything about it is kidding themselves. I think this is, to borrow Al Gore's phrase, an inconvenient truth. And it is maddening to me that the folks that are preaching listen to the scientists. When they get a fact that is inconvenient, they tend to ignore it. And you know, I guess it's human nature. It's easier to just focus and say that natural gas is cleaner than coal. It is cleaner for local pollution. And I must say, before the climate change became an issue, I was an advocate of using natural gas instead of diesel oil at the Port of Los Angeles. But when it comes to greenhouse gases, we now know that the methane is a huge thing. Besides, there's a large amount of methane that emits from landfills and from cows and things. Methane is a major greenhouse gas, so launching attack on carbon only is just ignoring a big source of the problem, and it is a source of the problem that makes natural gas as bad as coal. And I just think that's a statement that is backed up by just about every study that's been made. Now, most of this, I mean, the fact that EPA doesn't count methane doesn't mean it doesn't count. Mother Nature knows about it. And Mother Nature would send a memo to Barack Obama today. He says, nice try, kid, but you got to do more before you get my attention.
Well, but also the natural gas lobby and the oil and gas lobby have, they've been touting all over television this wonderful miracle greenhouse gas reducer. I mean, it's not as if...
They're the most effective lobbyists in the country. The gas industry is far outstripped the oil industry in its influence and in its ability to win over so-called good guys. And then there's another sleeper in the thing. I mean, this supporting old nuclear power plants, with all due respect, I think there's a special place in hell for the environmentalists who are supporting nuclear power, and especially supporting 35- and 40-year-old reactors that no one knows how long they're going to last. We got Fukushima's all over the country. And this policy, if you read the fine print, it enables a utility to count a nuclear power plant as an offset to continuing to burn coal, for God's sake. So they got the two poisons and saying if you use one poison, you can use both. Give me a break.
Well, David Freeman, I thank you very much for joining us. Unfortunately, the news is bad, but it needs to be made clear that...
Well, I think people need to be educated. I think the younger generation would get behind a comprehensive program if we had leadership that had the nerve to even put it on the table. That's my disappointment. I know you can't pass the time of day in this Congress, but we'll never get a program worthy of the name unless the President of the United States lays it out, and he didn't today.
Well, David Freeman, I thank you for joining us.
Bye-bye.
Again, I've been speaking with David Freeman, who's a leading authority on the production, management, and delivery of energy to large populations. He has had the ear of federal officials since the days of JFK and helped bring about the Environmental Protection Agency under President Nixon. He headed the Tennessee Valley Authority under President Carter and also headed New York Power and the Los Angeles Department of Water and Power, and was a state energy czar responsible for rescuing California from the predations of Enron and Company. David Freeman is the author of Winning Our Energy Independence, and Energy Insider Shows How. We're going to take a brief station break and be back when we'll be given a new economic vision to address climate change.
Buy it, use it, break it, fix it, trash it, change it, mail, upgrade it, charge it, point it, zoom it, press it, snap it, work it, quick erase it, write it, cut it, paste it, save it, load it, check it, quick rewrite it, plug it, play it, burn it, rip it, drag it, drop it, zip, unzip it, lock it, fill it, call it, find it, view it, code it, jump and lock it, surf it, scroll it, pose it, click it, cross it, crack it, switch, update it, name it, read it, tune it, print it, scan it, send it, fax, rename it, touch it, ring it, pay it, watch it, turn it, leave it, start format. Technologic.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Jeremy Rifkin, who is the author of The Zero Marginal Cost Society, The Internet of Things, The Collaborative Commons, and The Eclipse of Capitalism. He is an advisor to the European Union and to heads of state around the world, and is the president of the Foundation on Economic Trends in Washington, D.C. His latest article at the Huffington Post is Beyond Obama's Plan, A New Economic Vision for Addressing Climate Change. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jeremy Rifkin.
Nice to be with you, Ian.
And on Monday, the Obama administration unveiled its plans to curb CO2 emissions linked to climate change, tasking the Environmental Protection Agency to regulate CO2 created by power plants by 30%, reducing them by 30% from 2005 levels over the next 15 years. Obviously, in an election year, that's a touchy thing with a lot of Democrats running in coal states, one of whom is running against Mitch McConnell, who I imagine the Democrats would like to unseat. But nevertheless, my sense is that this is pretty modest, wouldn't you say?
Well, I think you're being charitable. I think it's very weak at best. And you know, it seems significant compared to what we haven't done in the last 10 or 15 years on climate change. So it's a little sad. A lot of the environmental groups are rallying to this cause because, you know, a half a loaf is better than no loaf at all, I guess. But what's so interesting about it is that even if they make all of these reforms, it's too little to address the enormity of climate change. And compared to what's happening in the European Union and now China, it's minuscule.
And as you point out in your article at the Huffington Post, Beyond Obama's Plan, A New Economic Vision for Addressing Climate Change, Jeremy Rifkin, already 27% of the electricity in Germany is being generated by renewable energy. And on Sunday, May the 11th of this year, 75% of Germany's electricity demand was generated by renewable energy. So the world is moving on. And I think in many ways, just to get a context on what you're talking about here, is the notion in your article of a third industrial revolution. Great Britain sparked the first industrial revolution. The United States led the world into the second industrial revolution. And China has set its sights on leading the world into the third industrial revolution by being the first superpower to build out an Internet of Things infrastructure and accompanying collaborative commons. So a lot of things that you have to define for us here, Jeremy. Start with the third industrial revolution, then Internet of Things, and then the collaborative commons.
All right. Well, you know, every great economic revolution contains three components: a new way to communicate, to manage economic activity, a new source of energy, and a new mechanism for transport and logistics to move economic activity. So in the 20th century, we had centralized electricity and the telephone. Radio and television was the communication media. Cheap oil, abundant cheap oil, was the energy source. And the internal combustion engine and national road systems was the logistics mechanism to move the economic value chain. And, of course, that second industrial revolution is dying. It's on life support. Fossil fuel energies are more and more expensive. And the technologies based on these energies, like the internal combustion engine and centralized electrification, are really moribund technologies. We really can't get much more productivity out of them. So the global growth is stalling, GDP is slowing, unemployment's rising, and we are in an economic system that is proving to be at an end game. The good news is we are on the cusp of a third industrial revolution, a new convergence of communication, energy, and transport and logistics. The communication internet, which we all enjoy now, is beginning to merge in Europe, and especially Germany and now China, with an energy internet based on the same principles and a fledgling transport and logistics automated system for moving goods and services. So we're beginning to see three internets in one: the communication internet, the emerging energy internet, a automated transport and logistics internet. Together they compose a single platform called the Internet of Things. The Internet of Things is a nervous system. It's like a brain. And sensors now are being attached across the value chain. So we're monitoring data on what's going on in our food production in the agricultural fields. We have sensors sending back data to these three internets from factory floors on what's going on our production lines. Warehouses, distribution centers, smart roads are monitoring traffic with freight. So we're beginning to create a system where this internet has become a super internet of things, connecting every device and every human being in one system. Now, here's what's interesting about it. Assuming network neutrality, which is a big assumption, that this super internet of things, it stays neutral, like the internet, and it isn't monopolized by big companies, and that's a big if. This means that anybody listening to what I'm saying now, and any small business, any cooperative, any individual can go up on this Internet of Things, just like you go up on the Internet now. You can access all the data coming across that system. And you can then use your own analytics with your own technology, your own mobile apps, and create your own algorithms, just like Google, and be able to produce your own renewable energy, 3D printed products, at near zero marginal cost, and share them with everyone else on a new economic system that's emerging called the collaborative commons. It's already here in Europe. Let me give you an example. Let me talk about zero marginal cost, though, for your listeners. Marginal cost is the cost of producing an additional unit of a good or service after your fixed costs are absorbed. So, you know, business people have always wanted to reduce their marginal cost. It's just they never expected a technology revolution so extreme in its productivity that it could reduce marginal cost to near zero, making energy and goods and services nearly free and no longer subject to profit and the marketplace. That's the revolution that's going on that Obama's missed. You know, in the last 15 years, I don't have to tell you because you spent a life in media, we have seen zero marginal cost dramatically impact information goods. Hundreds of millions of consumers became prosumers, young people. They began to produce and share their own music, bypassing the big recording industries. Then they began to share their own news and news blogs, bypassing the traditional print and electronic media to some extent. Then they began to share their own books with free e-books and their own knowledge in Wikipedia. And they began to do this at near zero marginal cost. It doesn't cost much to produce and share information goods on a collaborative commons. And it's brought havoc to traditional media. But economists, Ian, always assumed there'd be a firewall and that the zero marginal cost would not move from the virtual world of information goods to the physical world, the brick-and-mortar world. That firewall has been breached as this Internet of Things emerges now in Germany and beginning in China. And where you're seeing it is in energy, renewable energy. This is what President Obama has missed. We have millions and millions of players in Europe, cooperatives, urban and rural cooperatives, small businesses, homeowners, who are actually producing their own solar and wind electricity, millions of them, right now, at near zero marginal cost. The technology is still pricey for harvesting the energy, solar and wind, but it's on an exponential curve by computer chips. So, you know, it used to cost, you remember, it cost $60 a watt to produce a watt of solar electricity in 1970. It's 66 cents a watt today. So it's on a similar curve, but these harvesting technologies are going to be as cheap as cell phones and desktop computers in 10 years. But even now in Europe, once you introduce a solar panel or a wind turbine, the marginal cost of producing that green electricity in Germany now is nearly zero because the sun is free. You just have to capture it. The wind is free. You just have to grab it. The geothermal heat under your ground is free. You just have to hold on to it. So in Germany, we now have 27% green electricity. We're heading to 35%. And you know who's producing it? Millions of small players. The big power companies that we thought were invincible in Germany, like E.ON, EMBW, Vattel, they have been pounced, just like the recording companies when people started to share music laterally. And they're now generating less than 7% of the new energies in Germany. The vast majority of that energy is being produced by small producer co-ops, urban, rural co-ops, families, farmers, and it's a revolution. It's power to the people. And that's now starting to migrate to China. Premier Li, the new premier, read my book, The Third Industrial Revolution. He announced when he was premier that he was a fan. And they just introduced an $82 billion four-year commitment to introduce the energy internet across China so that millions of Chinese people can produce their own solar and wind electricity and share it with each other on an energy internet. So we're beginning to see a shift from these giant vertically integrated power and energy companies that controlled the second industrial revolution of the 20th century to small players, millions and millions of small players around the world producing solar and wind at near zero marginal cost, nearly free, and sharing it with each other on an emerging collaborative commons. So it's really power to the people in a very figuratively, really, and literally. And now you're seeing it with 3D printed products. We've got hundreds of thousands of hobbyists, thousands of small startup companies who are printing out manufactured products, and they're using open source software. It's all free. And the actual material they're using to print out these products is things like recycled plastic, recycled paper. Stone and gravel is being melted down, so it's almost free filament. And then they're powering their 3D printed factories in Germany with their own renewable energy at near zero marginal cost. And within a few years, they'll be able to transport it to market the products in their fuel cell and electric vehicles, GPS guidance, again, at near zero marginal cost. That's what's happening in parts of Europe. We haven't begun to touch that here in the United States, with the exception maybe of California, the West Coast, and a few other places.
Again, I'm speaking with Jeremy Rifkin, who is the author of The Zero Marginal Cost Society, The Internet of Things, The Collaborative Commons, and The Eclipse of Capitalism. He is an advisor to the European Union and to heads of state around the world, and is the president of the Foundation on Economic Trends in Washington, D.C., and his latest article at the Huffington Post is Beyond Obama's Plan, A New Economic Vision for Addressing Climate Change. And just touching on another definition, prosumer. That is that Alvin Toffler's idea of
a
proactive...
Yeah, you know, you and I are old enough to remember that. When he first came
I actually know him. He lives here in L.A., you know.
Well, tell him I send my warm regards. And, you know, at first I was dubious about the word, but he really did get it 30, 40 years ago. Prosumers are consumers who then become the producers, as well as producing the products and services. They also consume it or share it with others. So we are seeing literally 40% of the human race is now connected to the Internet. And at one time or another, every one of those persons has been a prosumer, producing and sharing their own information. It can be YouTube videos. It can be, you know, Wikipedia contributions or whatever. But now what we're seeing in energy is even more exciting, that we have now millions of people producing their own green electricity at near zero marginal cost and sharing it, and now 3D printed products. What's happened here, which is really rather extraordinary, is we're seeing the emergence of a new economic system on the world stage. It's called the Collaborative Commons. This is really the first new economic system that's emerged since the advent of capitalism and socialism in the early 19th century. So it's a remarkable historical event. And it has big implications because it's not only that young people are beginning to use the Internet and now the Internet of Things to be able to produce and share information goods and energy and 3D printed products with each other, bypassing the market. They're also sharing their own automobiles, their own homes, their own clothes. We've got millions of young people who prefer not to own a car. They'd rather have access to mobility by either using a profit or a non-profit car sharing service. And for every car that is shared, and there are millions of kids now moving from ownership to access, they just want mobility. For every car shared in, 15 cars are removed from the road. And if you realize that the car was the centerpiece of economic growth in the 20th century, it's a big change. And from a climate point of view, we have a billion vehicles out there emitting CO2. And if Larry Burns, the former head of GM, did a study saying in Ann Arbor, Michigan, he did a study and found that we could have the same mobility we have now with 80% fewer cars if we shared them. So extrapolate that toward a billion vehicles producing CO2. We don't need 800 million of those. And the other, we can car share on a collaborative commons and connect through the web. And the other 200 million vehicles can be electric and fuel cell vehicles powered by our own green electricity. Take homes and apartments. We've got couch surfing, which I like because it's a free service, and we have Airbnb, which is commercial. But millions of young people now, they're not going to hotels, brick-and-mortar hotels. They are renting out their apartments, or they have a home and they're renting out their home because they're already paying the fixed cost on the rental and they're already paying their mortgage, so the marginal cost of making their home available for someone to use a spare room is nearly zero marginal cost. And so in New York last year, Airbnb, the commercial service, they wiped out 1 million hotel nights. Now, hotels and resorts in the travel industry is 9% of GDP, and it's a huge emitter of CO2. So if more and more people are sharing their cars and sharing their homes, it means that more people are sharing fewer abodes, and that means less CO2 is being emitted. Same with clothes. We have these sites on the Collaborative Commons that share clothes, so like ThredUp and other sites. So let's say you have a kid that outgrows their clothes or outgrows their toys. You can send them back to the Collaborative Commons, and you get a credit. And as because your child's a year older, they need new clothes and new toys. And so you get a credit, and you can go up on these huge collaborative commons websites and pick from thousands and hundreds of thousands of items. And it may not show up in the GDP because more people are sharing fewer clothes, fewer toys. That's less CO2 emissions. That's a circular economy where we use the Internet of Things to directly engage each other. We kind of bypass the middlemen and these vertically integrated companies, and we become our own prosumers, and we begin to produce at near zero marginal costs, which means less resources used. And then what we do produce, we share with each other over and over again, and our clothes, our toys, and never goes to the landfill. This is the alternative economic vision that really will allow us to address climate change, democratize the economy, and allow a more sustainable world to flourish. And it's light years away from what Obama's talking about in just reducing emissions in old coal power plants that we're going to go out of business anyway.
Well, but the other companies that you mentioned, or at least the big sectors of our economy, the car manufacturers, the automobile accessories, tires, oil and gas, the carbon-based companies, the hotel and travel industry, they're, in effect, what you're saying is that they're no different from the coal-fired power plants. They just don't know it yet.
Yeah, that's what we're seeing. What we're seeing is, you know, we tend to think that these big global companies are invincible because the Fortune 500 companies control a lot of the GDP in the world, but they're dinosaurs. During their period of time, not all of them, a lot of them will survive, but a lot of them are going to be very, very vulnerable because we created these big companies in the late 19th and 20th century because they're the most efficient ways to manage the technologies that we had at the time. Fossil fuel energies are very centralized, and the telecommunication system of the 20th century, very centralized. So we had to create lots of capital in order to vest these companies so they could be on a national scale. And we created economies of scale, vertically integrated companies, so that we could get a return on investment, and it required a lot of capital. So the result is, by the end of the 20th century, you had 500 companies, very vertically integrated, controlling key sectors and industries. And so it's no surprise that much of the revenue went to the top. Some of the revenue flowed out to the rest of us, better wages, better jobs, but a lot of the revenue flowed to the top. And this is what Thomas Piketty missed in his book, Capital in the 21st Century. I mean, we all understood that capital was flowing to the few, but that's kind of a tautology on to say that, you know, the capitalists control the capital. What he didn't say in his book is that it was the technological infrastructure, the communication, the energy, the transport and logistics system of the 20th century that required vertical integration to put out cheap products and to be able to get the investments back and create economies of scale. What's so interesting about the Internet of Things is it's a different architecture. The Internet of Things, communication Internet, energy Internet, and logistics Internet, is designed not to be centralized. Its whole architecture is to be distributed and collaborative, and it favors peer production in lateral economies of scale. This is what the kids learned with file-sharing music. They could organize millions of small players in lateral economies of scale, and they could really decimate vertically integrated operations overnight. Then we saw it with the newspapers, the magazines. We saw it when Wikipedia, you know, trounced Encyclopedia Britannica. We saw it in the book industry. Now we're seeing it in energy in Germany, where millions of small players in a few years came together on an Internet of Things, and that energy Internet allows small players to come together in cooperatives, scale their activity laterally, lateral power, and within 5 years, the big power and energy companies of Germany had the same fate as the music and recording industries here and the newspaper and publishing industries. So this is the new message in my book, the Zero Marginal Cost Society. We are really on the cusp of a great advance in technology that allows us to move toward a world where we can democratize economic life just like we began to democratize communication.
Well, just in the last minute then, Jeremy Rifkin, as you point out in your article at the Huffington Post, Beyond Obama's Plan, A New Economic Vision for Addressing Climate Change, that a Stanford University study says that that if 20% of the world's available wind was harvested, it would generate seven times more electricity than we currently use to run the entire global economy. And also you talk about feed-in tariffs that the rest of the world has used to spur solar power, and only in the United States, California, Vermont, Maine, Oregon, Washington, Hawaii, and Rhode Island have even a cursory feed-in tariff. So
right.
Just give me a sense then of how we get over the cusp here. You've got the big dinosaurs controlling the economy or dominating the economy, and you've got this free wind and free sun out there ready to be harvested.
Right.
How do you get across the hump?
Well, you know, the environmental organizations today are talking about, you know, there's a coalition of the environmental groups talking about it's time to protest, it's time to take these actions to the streets and demonstrate that we're really committed. But if the whole commitment is just reducing CO2 and coal-fired power plants, I'm all for that, let's eliminate them, that's not a positive message about our future. That's just one small benchmark along the way. We've got a whole generation of young millennial men and women out there who grew up on the Internet, and they are used to the idea of being empowered so that they can actually produce and share things with each other. So the next logical step is to go from producing and sharing YouTube videos and news blogs and information, entertainment, and sharing their own, producing and sharing their own renewable energy, their own 3D printed products, sharing their own clothes and toys and tools and whatever for their families on a collaborative commons. And it seems to me that new economic vision, that new economic system, the collaborative commons, is really the architecture for the younger generation. I would leave with this. Here's what I think what I'd leave with this point. There's a real generation shift here, Ian. You know, when we grew up, power was always considered pyramidal. The idea of peer-to-peer lateral power would be an oxymoron for an older generation. But when young people in the millennial generation think about power, they have a completely different idea. They don't talk about, you know, capitalism and socialism and right and left. It's not really in their vocabulary. When they view institutional behavior, millennial kids, young men and women, when they look at governments or political parties or school systems or businesses, they ask, is the power, the institutional power, centralized, top-down, proprietary, and closed? Or is the institutional power distributed, collaborative, transparent, open, and does it favor peer-to-peer lateral power? That's a real shift. And the Internet of Things platform provides a framework for a third industrial revolution and the emergence of this new economic system, a collaborative commons, in which we can actually produce and share our energy and goods and services at near zero marginal cost, and in a sustainable circular economy. So it's here for the taking. Germany's doing it. China's beginning to do it. We need to follow that lead. And I think once Americans get the narrative, we can move very quick. I think the younger generation has to move beyond these simple stopgap measures on coal-fired plants. That's fine. But we need to move forward and actually advocate a new economic vision and game plan for the U.S. similar to the EU and China.
Well, Jeremy Rifkin, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
My pleasure, Ian. Thanks for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Jeremy Rifkin, who is the author of The Zero Marginal Cost Society, The Internet of Things, The Collaborative Commons, and The Eclipse of Capitalism. He is an advisor to the European Union and to heads of state around the world, and is the president of the Foundation on Economic Trends in Washington, D.C., and his latest article at the Huffington Post is Beyond Obama's Plan, A New Economic Vision for Addressing Climate Change. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Let's